Welcome to The Vinyl Exam. I'm your host, Keith, and this is episode 154. Something I'm going to try to do more of this season and hopefully going forward is to talk about things behind the records we love. A microphone, a guitar, etc. Just something that has been adopted as a standard. And we're going to go down the extreme metal path today, and we're going to talk about a particular guitar pedal that has had a huge impact on a subgenre of extreme metal, the Boss HM2. And without getting too much into it, the Boss HM2 ended up being a signature sound for some of the early death metal bands. And it has become a recent obsession of mine and has spurned a lot of boutique clones in terms of pedals. As I've gone down the vortex of trying to not only get this tone, but examine why I like it and listen to a bunch of both past records and current records that use variations on the theme, I came across an article by Gus Butler of Cult Nation. That's CVLT Nation. And Gus has a basically like an oral history, and he talks to all kinds of people that played a role back in the day for the HM2 and people that are currently contributing to it as well. So Gus was gracious enough to lend some time to the podcast. So we're going to talk to him about not only the HM2, but his record collecting and the other things he's into as well. So let's get to it. I'm guessing you're pretty fluent in metal, right?
I am, but here's the funny thing is when I was a teenager, when this was, you know, kind of the first wave of Sweet Death and everything was coming out, I was really more into industrial and electronic music. So I came to metal a little bit kind of after the fact. I've probably been, you know, really hardcore into metal for the last 12, 13 years, but I also sort of missed the first Sweet Death wave, so I've kind of like been going back and picking stuff up too.
Interesting. Are you a big fan of the current Renaissance wave of HM2 stuff, for lack of a better way to put it?
I dig Bloodbath and Paganizer and Gate Creeper and, you know, some of the more widely known type bands, and you know, some of the smaller ones. You know, there's living out here in Portland, there's a lot of great death metal bands, Petrification and Witch Vomit and stuff. But you know what first turned me on to getting more into what led to that article is I'm a big guitar pedal nerd.
Okay.
So I'm one of those guys who, if I go to a show, you know, while everyone else is in the back having a drink and, you know, maybe looking at the merch table, I'm up looking at the stage to see what pedals people have, what guitars people have, what amps people have. And I just kept seeing, you know, these same pedals over and over, the, you know, HM2 derivatives, Lone Wolf stuff and Abominable stuff and some Dunwich stuff. And it just got me more and more interested in kind of how that went. And I couldn't think of another pedal that was as tied to a wave of metal as the HM2. So it was just sort of like a dovetail of those two interests coming together.
Interesting. So I take it you play if you're a guitar pedal nerd.
I play. I mean, I don't play great.
Yeah.
I just like the technology I've got, you know. I'm on guitar pedal forums. I have gone through the whole rigmarole of trading and swapping and buying. And, you know, again, Portland has a bunch of great guitar shops, so I can go out and test stuff. But yeah, I have a little modest setup and my board has gone from one pedal to 30 pedals.
And,
you know, switchers and loopers and all sorts of crazy stuff. But yeah, they just interest me. I just kind of find that fascinating. I mean, I nerd out on it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because I think I'm on that curve right now. As of 6 months ago, I owned maybe one pedal. And now I think I just sold a few, but I think I'm at 8 maybe. And that's, it's just going up, you know, and I have, yeah. And I have, I actually have an original, I just bought a Japan Circuit HM2 and had originally bought the Throne Torture. That was the first one I got. But now, you know, I think in your article, it mentioned that Gate Creeper, a band that I love right now, uses a modified left-hand Wrath Deluxe. Yeah, and now I'm like, maybe I should get a left-hand Wrath, you know?
Yeah, and then you start thinking like, well, how many, you know, what are the differences? What can the nuances be? But if you really get into guitar pedal geekdom, you know, I mean, you could have 30 different Big Muff pedals and every one of them would sound different, and people geek out but over transistors. You know, having done the whole guitar pedal thing for years, I was used to that with fuzz pedals and overdrive pedals and all this stuff. But, you know, distortion pedals seem pretty basic. You know, you're just clipping the signal real hard. But yeah, the whole HM2 thing fascinated me because I think it's only been the last few years that a bunch of builders have started getting on the train.
Yeah,
you know, the three I mentioned in the article, you know, those are like real metal guys, and they're really interested in it. But over the past few years, some of the bigger pedal manufacturers that have a little bit of everything have kind of grabbed at the HM2 circuit. So, you know, something is making them see dollar signs. You know, if I get in on this, I can, you know, people will buy it. And that also fascinated me because, you know, if somebody makes a version one Big Muff, you know, you can't find an original, or if you can, it's going to be $300-$400. It might not work, or, you know, an old fuzz face or whatever. But, you know, these HM2 pedals, you can find them. They're not super expensive. They probably still work the way they did 10 years ago. So what was making people, you know, want to put together what is actually a really complicated circuit for a one-trick pony. But yeah, it just struck me as really interesting. For like the past decade, metal has pretty much been like my primary focus. When I was a teenager and was into a lot of the industrial stuff, there were bands that would kind of, you know, rub up against both camps. Like, I've listened to Godflesh since, you know, forever. Mm-hmm. And bands like that kind of would add some electronics in, or, you know, a lot of my buddies were into metal, so some things would sort of hit my radar. And, you know, there's industrial bands like KMFDM that use a lot of or at least in the 90s, use a lot of kind of metal guitars with their sound. But it was kind of moving out to Portland and befriending a dude named John who ran Anthem Records at the time. And every day at lunch, I would go over and pretty much just spend my entire paycheck on records. And he really turned me on to metal. And that's when I got into, you know, kind of the more esoteric, like black metal stuff and really diving into all the different branches.
What do you think it was about the HM2 sound that grabbed you? You know, there's an appeal to all these things, right? To all these subgenres. What was it about the HM2, the Swedish sound that grabbed you?
I guess it's the idea that you know, it's on the one hand kind of samey, like it's a limited palette, but these bands all did so much different stuff with it. And a lot of bands at the time just had terribly crap gear. You know, they were playing through solid state PV amplifiers and just junk, but they were able to get this great raw sound out of it. Maybe even almost become a cliche at this point, but there's just something about that sound that just kind of screams metal. Doesn't feel overproduced or slick. It's just kind of raw in there. And as soon as you hear it, you know what you're going to get. You know, I mean, if you play it a minute into any Sweet F album and you're like, okay,
yeah. nice thing about this particular, if you want to call it a wave, or you know, I don't like calling it a trend, but it's definitely a thing that a lot of people are picking up on more and more, especially since you hinted at the boutique pedal makers and the big boys latching onto this. You know, the internet goes back far enough to predate this trend now. And that's something I find super interesting, because when I was researching, actually I found you because I'm just obsessed with the HM2 stuff as well. And I follow Abominable Electronics on Facebook, and they mentioned this article, and I'm like, this sounds like an amazing article, right? And so I've just read up on everything I can, and it's really interesting because, you know, on the third page of any Google search, you're going to all of a sudden get some posts from 2008. You know, and it was like, I think on the third page, you have this guy going, yeah, I bought an HM2. People don't really care about it right now, but I really like this sound, you know, X, Y, and Z. You think about the fact that that predates all of the new bands. It's really a time when a lot of this stuff was just a wasteland of the unknown. And I'm sure there were a few truthers, but not many. Okay, so how did Cult Nation come in the picture?
Being a metal fan, there's, especially when you're kind of really trying to chase down the weirder stuff, there's just a few blogs that are gonna hit your radar. Cult Nation and, you know, Angry Metal Guy and No Clean Singing and things. So, you know, they were something I was reading anyway, and then they sort of posted out of the blue, I think on their Facebook, that they wanted more writers because they were trying to expand what they call the cultural arm of their website. They wanted to do more than just music reviews. And they said, if you are interested, send us an email and tell us why we should think about you and ideas you have. So I just sort of out of the blue said, hey, why not? I wrote them an email, pitched a few things at them, and they said, yeah, let's give it a try. And, you know, I started... Actually, if you look at my author bio, there's a lot of stuff on weird fiction and weird lit and authors and whatnot, which, you know, I'm an English teacher, so that's just kind of part of who I am. And I've also on all these pedal sites and everything, and the idea just struck me that, you know, I kind of woke up one day and thought, man, I really want to try doing an oral history, putting one together, but what would it be about? And the HM2 just sort of popped into my head, and yeah, it took a while to put together, but it was cool.
The great thing about it is, I think you managed to get every single, if you want to call it pillar, every single pillar of people that have been part of this sound. You know what I mean? And some pretty great material from absolutely everybody, from back in the Originator days to, you know, the Kurt Ballou, who's basically the kind of modern day flag bearer for whether he wants to be or not, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, I know I shouldn't read comment sections about stuff that I write, because, you know, it just turns into a black hole, but people have commented on the article, like, why didn't he talk about so-and-so, or why didn't he interview so-and-so, and, you know, without naming names, there's a bunch of people I did contact about the article who very graciously said, you know, we're not interested, or we don't have time, or whatever, so there's, I contacted a lot of people who didn't end up in the article for whatever reason. And, you know, at the end of the day, I didn't want it to just be like an encyclopedia entry, just a big list of here's everyone who used it. So, like you said, I wanted a few people from the first wave, a few people who are using it for this kind of second wave of Swedeath, and then, you know, people who would have more of a tech idea about it. So I just tried to skim a little bit out of all the pools.
The gearhead, it skews gearhead, right? It skews pedal nerd. I find that interesting, but it also kind of begs the bigger question of, does it seem like the majority of people that are interested in this sound are all like pedal nerds and gear nerds?
Probably. I mean, you know, it's rare that you see a pedal board with something boutique on it, and that's the only pedal, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll see a band that has like maybe just a Boss, you know, maybe they have the original HM2, or you know, I saw Undergang a few months ago, and he just uses this one Boss like mega distortion thing. But if somebody is putting out the money and getting on a wait list to get something boutique, they are probably a tech nerd, and there's probably six or seven other pedals, you know, on either end. So, yeah. And then as far as interest in the article, I think it's probably appeals to total pedal nerds and people who are just into metal. And it's the metal people who have kind of picked me apart and said, you know, why didn't you talk about so-and-so, whereas the pedal geeks are just happy to read about anything gear-related.
And I suppose that it kind of turns to into a larger question of, you know, in doing a lot of research on any HM2 stuff, it does become kind of interesting that it's a subgenre that becomes defined solely by a guitar sound. Like, not the lyrical content, not the scene, not anything, just that sound, you know?
Right, and not even, and it's funny because it's the guitar sound, but the actual guitar in question is sort of moot, and the amps are sort of moot. And I think that's what really appealed to me about it is, you know, it's this one pedal that was made for a handful of years that is, even the people who love it will admit that it's got more shortcomings than it has positives. And basically it's got one sound, but its sound is so distinct and so unique that it just sort of defined something. And I suppose you could say that once it got tied to a specific studio and that's where, you know, a certain number of bands start going, then, you know, is it the pedal or is it the fact that all these bands were going to the same place to record? But for whatever reason, yeah, that one pedal is genre in and of itself now.
If you happen to be a fan of, I can't remember if it's Malcolm Gladwell or are you a fan of Malcolm Gladwell or people that write a lot like him?
My tastes are mostly run fiction and kind of the horror end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, ironically, now that I'm in my ninth year of being an English teacher, I probably read less than I ever have in my life. Because
isn't that the way? Yeah.
Usually if I'm reading an essay that 100 essays that got turned in, but
sure.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, that makes sense. Cause I have three stepdaughters and I keep telling them, you know, they're reading books that they're assigned. And I keep telling them, I'm like, just plug through these books because at some point in your life, you're going to get to read anything you want. It's all going to be your choice and you're really going to enjoy making those choices. You know, I didn't enjoy reading that much in high school. I'm sure you do your best to keep the reading material interesting.
Well, you know, you do what you can. I mean, I don't always have total autonomy over what my kids are reading.
Right.
You know, you do what you can to at least have what they're doing with it.
Yeah.
Be somewhat appealing.
Yeah, it's like being a disc jockey where 55 or you know, I guess 45 of your 50 minutes every hour are programmed for you, and you get to choose that one song an hour that reflects you and kind of mix it up, right?
Right. Yeah.
But I guess the thing I was going to mention, there's this interesting effect. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's like the Mona Lisa effect. Like, what makes the Mona Lisa such a definitive thing? Was it inherent greatness, or was it the fact that people recognize greatness, which kind of tumbled downhill into more greatness and more recognition and even more greatness? It's not a matter of how great it is. It's just the fact that it's universally acknowledged as this symbol of greatness. And so you kind of mention about the, oh God, of course the name escapes me, but the studio in Sweden that became the big place. And it's like, you know, to your point, they may not have wanted to be known for that, but then by getting known for it, they became more known for it. It's kind of an interesting cycle.
Yeah, and just any branch of metal or any kind of music. But, you know, I feel like metal and rap in particular are not just tied to sonics, but a lot of times they're tied to geography. Mm-hmm. You know, you find yourself throwing out not just a genre of metal, but a specific country in which the genre originated. It's kind of funny to think, you know, well, how does this start? How does the scene start? And then why do certain things get attributed to it? And, you know, sometimes it's riffs and sometimes it's speed and sometimes it's sonics, et cetera, et cetera. But I can't think of another piece of specific gear that's as tied to a branch of metal as that pedal.
Yeah, yeah. No, and your comment about scenes and geography is pretty interesting too. I've never really thought about the fact that hip hop also has that.
And yeah.
And you're right. You know, you refer to, you know, there's a type of death metal called Norwegian death metal. And there's Swede death and there's Florida death metal, right? So no, that is I've never really thought about it that way.
Yeah, and same with black metal, and you know, I mean the US black metal versus European black metal, and then even within European black metal, you break it down by geography. And you know, it makes sense. You know, when I was a teenager, there was a big hardcore scene where I was, and hardcore certainly is tied to specific areas in the country, and every kind of geographic area had its unique sound. And you know, I don't know what I'm not sure if the connection between rap and metal is maybe a fringe element, or you know, if being a fringe type person is what pushes you to develop your own scene, and that's why geography becomes so important, because you know you're doing it yourself, you're putting it together yourself. A lot of bands end up being incestuous and share members. Something I'd like to explore more though, like why sounds are attributed to these areas.
I actually just paid for and watched a very long series of videos that he had done on how to, it's on Creative Live, right? And it's the basically making, mixing, mastering a record. It is excellent for someone who runs their own studio and or has a massive budget, because while it's full of tips and tricks, it also tends up to kind of be a backdoor gearhead class where it's just, I have this awesome piece of gear. He doesn't describe it as awesome. He'll say, oh, this piece of gear is pretty cool. I used it for this. And then you inevitably look it up and it's either, you know, super rare, super expensive, or both of those things. It was interesting because in one of the guitar sessions, you know, it was at the time it was a live class. And people could ask questions from the chat room, and he got the question on the HM2 sound, basically, and he then took some time to talk about it, and you know, he made the interesting comment that you can almost predict, which is anytime he gets a lot of these bands in his studio that have become known for the current wave of the HM2 sound, almost all of them insist on creating a tweaked version because they're a little too self-aware of the fact that this is a current trend. It's a current thing now.
They want to get some mileage out of the familiarity and the nostalgia, but they also don't want to be claimed as being totally derivative. So they need to, you know, put their own little tweak on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I suppose that's where you get into, you know, the boutique pedal market. You know, certainly there's things like their true bypass and better power consumption and all that, but adding, you know, maybe more control over the mid range and, you know, clean blends and all of that can allow a band to have that sound that tickles all the nostalgic buttons, but they can also, you know, kind of add their own little thing to it.
Any of these pedals?
There's going to be so many times where I admit that I metal people are going to jump on and say I knew it, he's a fraud. I don't, and mainly because you have to play so loud for them to be, you know, at their best. Mm-hmm. I've played through them, and anytime I'm at a store that has one and will let me kind of go to the back room and shut the door, I'll use it. And I've brought a few home, but they just don't sound good at the volumes that I can really get away with.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, and you have young kids, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, even the best ones are meant to be just destroying the front end of an amp. I can't get away with it, unfortunately.
No, that makes sense.
I own a few. I own, I think I mentioned, I have the HM2 and I have the Throne Torture. And the Deluxe Left-Hand Path is very high on the list. but but it's interesting because, you know, I have a bedroom studio. And even playing them, I mean, you make a good point. And I have, you know, it's not anything special, but it gets loud quickly, right? And even then you can see. So no, I totally get that. And I do have one stupid side comment, which is it's the only guitar sound that's made my wife open the door into my studio and ask, like, are you going to be done soon?
Yeah.
So I feel like, yeah, okay, I've got something special here if everybody in the house hates it, you know.
Well, and I feel like too, you know, you start playing an HM2 pedal and, you know, you're not going to find yourself playing some blues licks or, you know, ambient passages. I mean,
yeah.
you can't not start chugging away or doing some crazy lead lines. Like, it just kind of forces you in a certain direction.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly they're not only used by Sweet Death stuff. You know, I mean, I'm pretty sure Justin Broderick of Godflesh has used it. You know, Trap Them has used them with Kurt Ballou, and obviously they're not Sweet Death, but, you know, you play into one and it's going to force you in a certain direction. You're going to start playing loud and you're going to start turning up and, you know, you're going to start pissing off anyone within your shot.
So you've basically been a record nerd or a music nerd for a long time. How long?
I mean, I've been, you know, ever since, let's see, I'm 35 and I probably got my first CD player when I was 10. And, you know, I grew up in a house with both my parents are ex-hippies. So there was always music playing. So, you know, music has just been part of my life for forever. Ever since I was really able to start buying music, I've been, you know, going to the weird sections of the record store, you know, either metal or industrial electronic. I went through a big drone period, but yeah, just always. I mean, and anyone who knows me, you know, will mention music. You know, that's just, all my friends were music nerds, and it was always about who has the more obscure CDs and their giant wallets that we used to carry around in the 90s,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Carrying around those huge binders full of CDs.
Give it enough time and it'll come back around. Everything else does.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, I mean, and right now I've gotten on the tape train.
As have
mainly
I.
Mainly because there are a lot of bands who put out tape only stuff, and there's a lot of labels that are just focused on tape.
Yeah. It's cost efficient too. I think that's
exactly
the best part.
I mean, it's only a few dollars more than a download, and I still get the physical thing. And,
exactly,
you know, I get to support a band and support a label.
And you don't have an upfront cost of a minimum of $800 or $900 the way you do if you want to even press up 100 records.
Yeah, exactly. It totally makes sense. And I think because of that, a lot of the most, in my mind, interesting labels right now are either doing only tapes or are doing, you know, a big arm of what they're doing are tapes, because the upfront cost is so low, they can take chances on stuff that, you know, might frighten somebody where the upfront cost is a lot higher.
Yeah.
And you can get a hold of demos and you know, really fringe stuff by people who have no interest in putting their music on YouTube or SoundCloud or Bandcamp. But anyway, yeah, I kind of got off track there. But
No, that makes there is no off track. That's awesome.
But yeah, always music all the time.
English teacher, right? What grade?
What grades? 7th and 8th. And
okay.
I say that because some years I've done 7th and some years I've done 8th. I'm doing 8th right now.
Okay. And so you've hinted a couple times that you like weird / horror fiction. So yeah. Who are some of your favorite authors?
Brian Evanson is my absolute favorite author. I have everything he's done and managed to get them all signed and inscribed. Laird Barron right now is probably one of the best. If you're interested in kind of like what people are doing with the Lovecraftian Elder God thing right now, Matthew Bartlett, just putting out awesome stuff and just weird and kind of grossly funny. And a lot of these guys I've written about. I have a piece on Matthew Bartlett, and I saw a movie premiere of Laird Barron's, the first movie that's been made out of his work, They Remain, at the H.P. Lovecraft Festival here in Portland.
I've never felt that people can do H.P. Lovecraft well. You know, I've always felt that the best impersonation of H.P. Lovecraft maybe got you like 60 or 65% of the way there. So it's a strange subgenre. You know, in a way it has some similarities to the HM2, I think, in that it's a very limited subgenre. But I think the difference is that the current, and hopefully maybe these guys have done it, but up until recently, I never felt that the current people really got all of what made Lovecraft awesome.
I would definitely check out Laird Barron if that's your take, because I feel like he's gotten at the essence of what's cool about the Lovecraft mythos. You know, this idea that our reality is, there's something behind it, and that, you know, there's almost this unknown layer that maybe the lizard part of our brain is aware of, but that we're purposefully obfuscating. In a way, he mixes a lot of like kind of pulp stuff, and he almost has some noir crime elements, and he's just great though. I would definitely check him out if you're into Lovecraft.
I mean, I've been to the Lovecraft Film Festival down here. I'm in Southern California. Yeah, it's in two spots. It's in Portland in your backyard, and I don't know if they do it anymore, but they did it in San Pedro here for a couple years as well. And you continue to write stuff for Cult Nation, right?
Yeah, I average, you know, one or two a month. It's when I have the time for it and when I have something that I think is worth writing. It's cool to see stuff in print, and it's cool to talk to people that otherwise I wouldn't really have a chance to talk to. And anytime I get a chance to support the local Portland scene, I try to do that, just because it's given a lot to me.
I have one more question for you. You know, the main question in your article seems to be, why is there such, back to the HM2, why is there such a boutique market for the clones when the original is so available? So what do you think the answer is?
You know, I think part of it is something we touched on earlier, in that bands kind of want to hit this duality of throwbacky nostalgia, but at the same time they don't want to be completely redundant, so they want to be able to get that sound but also tweak it a little bit past what people have done before. And then I think another thing is just that the builders, or at least the ones that I talked about in the article, they just really love this stuff. You know, I mean, I get the sense talking to the dude from Dunwich and Lone Wolf and Abominable, they would have reverse engineered that and made their own just for the fun of it, and just for the challenge. And then, you know, they get them in people's hands and people dig them, and then there's just more and more of a desire for it. You know, I think there's also just this aspect, especially with music nerds and gear nerds, that like, you know, I've got the, and you kind of touched on yourself, you have the Abominable and you want to try out the Left Hand Wrath Deluxe. Like, I've got this thing and it's great. I wonder what that guy's take on it is like.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And not even the grass is always greener, because you can certainly own three of them and not feel like you have to boot one. I think it's just you kind of always are searching for the next thing. And that's why I think so many music nerds are also gear nerds. You know, I think that it dovetails, you know, none of us are going to be satisfied with the records we buy this year and say, you know, I can take 2018 off. I got plenty of good stuff.
Yeah.
We're going to be searching for the next record. And I think it's the same with pedal nerds and gear nerds and guitar nerds.
Thanks for hanging out with us on this episode of The Vinyl Exam. As a reminder, this is one part of all the Vinyl Exam stuff that's out there. There's the website, www.thevinylexam.com. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and of course, Patreon. We have all kinds of good stuff over there on Patreon, so check us out. And speaking of Patreon, I'd like to thank our official vinyl examiners, Brian Siebold and Yan Wong, and of course, our executive producers, Janine Cuevas, Austell Gray, and Ben Lack. We'll see you next time.